Calling all lovers of mystery and fans of a good story. If you haven't already heard me talk about June's journey, you're in for a treat. It's time to don your detective hat in this free hidden object mobile game that delves into the captivating journey of June Parker, a self-proclaimed detective on a quest to unravel the mystery surrounding her sister's untimely death. In June's journey, you get to play as June, deciphering clues and unveiling secret plots within thousands of beautifully illustrated scenes. And did I mention it's set in the glitzy 1920s? New chapters are added weekly, so you will never run out of new thrills to uncover, and you can also personalize and decorate your very own Orchid Island where the story takes place. How sharp are your detective skills? Find out when you download June's Journey on your Android or iOS device, or play online via Facebook Games. Your detective journey awaits.
Contained herein are the heresies of Radolf Buntwine, erstwhile monk-turned-traveling medical investigator. Join me as I uncover the blasphemous truth of a plague-ridden world, that ours is not a loving God, and we are not its favored children. The Heresies of Radolf Buntwine, coming January 2nd, wherever podcasts are available.
It's time for the Life Writing Podcast with your hosts, authors and screenwriters Stephen Barnes and Tanana Reeve Du. All about creating the project of your dreams while living a balanced artist life. Be the hero or heroine of your own story. Sponsored by LifeWritingPremium.com. Get ready to write for your life.
Welcome to the Life Writing Podcast, where married authors and screenwriters Stephen Barnes and Tanana Reeve Du talk about writing during stressful times, breaking into Hollywood, and balancing life. Every week, we'll share more tips on how to build a better life while you create your dream projects, even if it's only at the rate of one sentence a day. Life writing is the application of the tools of writing to life and the tools of life to your writing. Hey, everybody, welcome. Yes, thank you. Settle down. We have a guest today. Lord, y'all don't know how to act. Okay, so once again, as you probably noticed, I am here solo. Steve is racing to finish his Mace Windu novel. So again, he has had to regretfully bow out of this week's podcast, although he was very excited about our guest and I talked to him about the book and everything. But we're still going to have a good time. We have Lamar Giles here. Yes, Lamar Giles is here. He's going to talk all about his new novel and his old novel and coming into the world as a writer. But of course, you know how we do. Before we do all that, I'd like to talk a little bit about what's going on. I mean, it's not actually church, but it could be. I mean, it could be church. So I am actually broadcasting this week from Atlanta. I have the great joy of spending a few days with my 89-year-old father, John Dorsey Jew Jr. And those of you who have read my novel, The Reformatory, which I will mention has been nominated for a Bram Stoker Award and an LA Times book prize. I'm very, very excited about all that stuff. And my father was a part of my research process. I was just telling him again how we went on the road back and forth between his former home in Quincy, Florida. Well, he's, you know, his other home, I should say, in Quincy, Florida, to Marianna, Florida. We talked about the civil rights movement. He helped me craft a scene in the judge's chamber based on his own work as a civil rights attorney. His was in the 1960s, even though this book is set in 1950. Unfortunately, not that much had changed. So that's not that big a difference. So I'm really excited to be here with Dad to play music. He likes to listen to classic jazz with me, blues. We watch black movies. We watch stand-up. And even though, you know, it is difficult to watch a parent aging, and he's 89, although he has longevity in his family, there are physical issues, there are cognitive issues. But I always remember this saying that my dad uses to power himself through whatever setback he's facing. And it sounds simple, but I'm telling you, I have adopted this. It is what it is. It is what it is. Those are some powerful words. Now, I remember during COVID, the former so-called president said that, and it sounded very dismissive and ridiculous when he said it. So it is what it is doesn't apply to every situation. And in fact, for a lot of us who are younger than 89, it is not what it is. If we're having some joint issues, if we're stiff, that doesn't mean, oh, well, it is what it is. That means it's time to start some yoga. It's time to change it up. It's time to change up the diet. There are a lot of things that we can do. But at my dad's age, I think when he says it is what it is, he gets it. He's 89. There are things that he cannot do the way he could as a younger man. And watching him age with that kind of emotional calm, let me tell you, you know, my mother was the most hands-on of my parents when we were younger. And she gave me those lessons on, you know, all of us, my sisters and I, those lessons on how to grow up and how to succeed. And he did too. And both of them did by example. But I've come to look at my father now as giving me as important lessons on how to age. And I'm so, so grateful for that. And that is basically what's going on this week. I'm finishing, you know, I'm working on a short story with Steve for the Stan anthology, The End of the World as We Know It, based in the world of Stephen King, which a little bit of pressure to really bring it with that story. So we're taking our time with it. And taxes, you know, I'm going to work on taxes. But aside from that, that's all that's going on. So before we bring on Lamar, we actually got a voicemail. So isn't that exciting? So I'm actually going to play this voicemail, and then I'm going to introduce our guest. Here's a voicemail from Dan Fields.
Hi, Tanana Reeve. Hi, Stephen. Thank you so much for Life Writing. My name's Dan Fields, and I was on a real hot streak publishing stories through 2021. Then things hit the brakes. The kids got older. The family needed more of me, and finding my creative momentum again was tough. The part you've played in that process has been tremendous. I'm so thankful. I love your work, love Octavia Butler, love Harlan Ellison and his complex legacy as well. This is a podcast I wish I had discovered a year ago. Thank goodness for the back catalog. I'm attacking my to write pile with newfound confidence, and I've got a novel in the editing phase right now. Thanks for all you do. It's more than you know. And shine on brightly.
That is so sweet. Thanks so much for that, Dan. Aww. That was, okay, well, yes, audience, it was sweet. It was very sweet. And that means a lot to both of us that the podcast has been that meaningful to you. We're just trying to sort of part the curtain a little bit and show people what habits and strategies have helped other writers and artists succeed and hopefully help motivate you too. So it sounds like we did. Now it's time, though, to bring on our guests. Lamar Giles is the author of the acclaimed novels The Getaway, The Last Day of Summer, Not So Pure and Simple, Spin, Fake ID, and has written for globally beloved brands like DC Comics, Star Wars, and National Geographic. He's a three-time Mystery Writers of America Edgar Award nominee, a recipient of the Black Caucus of American Library Association's Youth Literary Award, which is a big deal, and founding member of the nonprofit We Need Diverse Books. He resides in Virginia with his family. Everybody, you better bring it for Lamar Giles. Woo! Welcome to the Life Writing Podcast, Lamar.
Thank you for having me, and congratulations on all the success of the Reformatory. I got to say, it was the absolute best book I read last year. That's not an exaggeration. So it's all well-deserved. Oh, it's just, that book's amazing.
I totally, totally appreciate that. And I received that. That book took a long time to write, as you've probably heard. So it really means a lot when anybody says that they enjoyed it. Because, yeah, and also I'm a writer, so that never actually gets old. But you have a book coming out that is not in your bio, but I read, to give it a quote, called Ruin Road. Boy, you put your foot in that book.
Thank you.
It is such a good book. And I guess, you know, a lot of the time on this podcast, we start at the beginning of a writer's career. But I'm going to start in the future. I'm going to start with your upcoming book because it just, it, you know, the thing I kept wondering as I was reading it, and by the way, that book made me actually cry, like sob cry at one point, because one of the themes has to do with family loss. And, you know, I have an older father, and we went through the loss of my mother in, you know, a few years ago. So that really spoke to me, but so much of it spoke to me. And it really had me pondering sort of a continuation of the conversation I had with our guest Alma Katsu last week, which is how labels and genre work, because you have young adult protagonists. The book is marketed as YA. A lot of your work, in fact, most of your work, I think it's fair to say, has been middle grade YA as well, correct?
That's correct.
But also as an adult reader, and I know a lot of so-called adults read YA, but this was one that really struck me as it's just horror to me. I mean, that YA label, it's interesting, but to me, it's just very imaginative, very gripping, and very compelling horror. So how does this label thing work in your head? I'm very curious.
Well, the way I've come to process the idea of the young adult book is really centered around the young adult protagonist, which is the protagonist that's under the age of 18, typically in high school. And that's, I know you can have adult marketed books with a young hero who fits that criteria. But specifically for my work and my publisher, a lot of the things we do to make sure that the book has a wide reach in schools, libraries, things of that nature, is the protagonist is a teen. We tend not to have any curse words in the book.
I did notice that.
Very little sexual content in my books. And that's just a stylistic choice for the audience that I have. Now, there are certainly young adult books who have all of those things. So that's not a hard rule for anybody working in this space. But that's how I come to see it. And if one day I do want to publish some adult work, that will probably stray far from those constraints.
You'll be out there. You'll be out there. You know, the premise of your novel, and I'll let you actually describe it, but it's so compelling that even when I was just describing the premise to my husband, I started to tear up because I have a 20-year-old son who is 6'5" and who, frankly, is hyper aware of how people notice him when he walks into public spaces. And that's something that I've watched the progression of from the time he was younger and cute, you know. And then there's that phase where I remember being at an airport once and we were all three in line and Jason had moved away from us for a minute and came back and someone thought he had butt in line. And the guy behind us was like, "Excuse me, sir." And I'm like, "Oh shoot, they calling him sir?" He was like 13. And I was like, "Oh my God, it has begun. It has begun." And even though he called him sir, there was a little bit of edge in the voice, like confrontation in the voice. And to watch it happen in real time. Well, I'm getting teary now just thinking about it. So tell me how you came up with the premise for Ruin Road.
Well, so the premise of Ruin Road is a young football star named Cade Webster, who's beloved when he's on the field. But because he is a large Black boy, anywhere else he goes, there's always someone who's afraid of him, and he's aware of that. And a tricky incident one night has him end up in a very creepy pawn shop where he makes a purchase and the clerk's acting weird. And that translates as fear to Cade. And he utters the words, "I wish people would stop acting so scared around me." This is the wrong place and time to make a wish, because that wish comes true. And what happens is everyone Cade's around from that point forward is not only not afraid of him, they lose their fear of everything. And this begins to escalate into increasingly dangerous situations. And the premise comes from the very thing you just described, where we know our young people, Black children, are often viewed to be bigger, older, and scarier than they actually are. And that has resulted in many tragedies.
Yes.
Trayvon Martin, Tamir Rice. We could spend half an hour listing those names.
We sure could.
And I wanted to write a story where I examine what it was like if a child could walk through the world and people were not afraid of them. And there are still dire consequences to that. And it's a reflection of anxiety I feel, where you can walk into a place, whether I'm walking into a space with other writers that I admire, and I'm nervous and I feel like I'm the only one that's nervous.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted to play that out in the scariest terms possible. This is the first time I've gotten the chance to write a long supernatural piece. And an editor told me a long time ago, like, don't save anything. You never know when you get another chance to do it. So I threw in like all my favorite horror subgenres and tropes into this thing. And
listen, people get it. You sure did. All my favorites too, actually. And you know what's, I wish it was out in the world and we could just unpack it like everybody's read it, but it has that quality of unfairness because Kid is such a good kid and he doesn't deserve any of this, you know, and any of the unintended consequences of that wish. I mean, I think it's not too spoilery to say that at one point someone tells him, you know, when most people make wishes, they're so selfish, you know, but his wish was not, it really was, actually, you could read it as putting other people at ease, you know, but he couldn't possibly, like all young people, they lack wisdom. And in this situation, even an older person would have lacked the wisdom, because when you're dealing with the supernatural, you do not know what doors you're opening. It just kind of reminds me a little bit, at least that part of it, of The Devil in America by Kayashanti Wilson, which has a young protagonist who inadvertently does something. And it's so unfair. And the consequences are so big, so big. But I can't wait. When does this book come out?
September 17th. So. Woo! Several months away. I'm going to start trying to spread the word and hopefully get people on board, which particularly with the very lovely and gracious blurb you provided. Thank you for that.
Look, I could have said more. I could have written a whole paragraph about how much I love Bruin Road. So I'm excited for you. Let's go back to the beginning. Now that we've already discussed the future, how did you know you wanted to be a writer?
So it began as a young child. I was probably 8 years old, and I had a teacher that made our whole grade participate in this thing called Young Authors. And at that point, I was already reading ferociously. Like, my mom was really big on books being a part of her children's lives. So I was reading a whole bunch of stuff and never understood that actual people wrote the books.
Mm.
I grew up in a factory town called Hopewell, Virginia. So all I saw was factory workers, teachers, firefighters. Never saw a writer. Never understood that the books I got from the library were written by real people. They were like gods to me. And then this teacher says, you get to write and illustrate your own book. And so I wrote this book called Giant Dinosaur Inside about a kid who pulls a Godzilla out of a cereal box and won the contest.
That sounds great.
It's the first time I'm the best at anything. You know, I'm not the athlete my friends are. I'm not the student my friends are, but I'm the best writer. Pretty much grab onto that, not really knowing where it's going until I'm about 11 years old and I read It by Stephen King.
Mm.
And that blew me away again. And I'm like, hey, I want to know how this guy does what he does. And so from that point on through my teenage years, I would always tinker in secret. Like the only person that knew was my mom. She bought me a computer. And this was in the days when it wasn't common for people to have computers in their homes. And the computer, she said, was for my homework and for me to write my stories. Yeah, my mom's beautiful. Great.
Beautiful.
She knew that I had some interest there. Neither of us knew where it would go. And I was pretty good until late in my teen years when I started to realize I wasn't really finding the sort of work that I wanted to read. Like, I was looking for something very specific, and it was becoming discouraging because I started to think, like, maybe there was no such thing as a young Black male writer writing scary stuff.
And this is a familiar tale. I also went through a phase where I was looking for Black women writing horror, and there was nothing. Or at least nothing I could find.
Yeah, exactly. Like, the stuff was out there, and eventually I'm going to tell you what I discovered. But stuff was out there. I didn't know how to get to it. This was a long time ago. The internet was young. It was still hard to track down things that weren't in your immediate vicinity. And I discovered a book one summer that changed everything. And it was Blood Brothers by Stephen Barnes.
Are you serious?
Yes. Blood Brothers by Stephen Barnes.
And Steve
Barnes.
Isn't even here to hear it. Oh, yeah, my goodness.
Please tell him.
I will.
That book will hit every single thing I was looking for. Contemporary protagonist, supernatural magic, horror, smart Black dude. It showed me, like, okay, this is the sort of thing that's able to get published. So immediately I'm the type that's like, I can get published. And then I discovered a second book. And this book also changed everything once again. This was a little while later. It was My Soul to Keep by you.
Oh, by me. Holy cow. So we're like your literary godparents.
Let me tell you, between Stephen King, Stephen Barnes, yourself, and Brandon Massey.
Yes.
Y'all created the roadmap for me to get where I was.
That's great. That is so beautiful. Thank you for sharing that. In fact, I'm texting Steve right now to let him know.
I mean, and obviously I follow your work for years and years. I don't know if Steve remembers this, but my first young adult novel, Fake ID, there's a principle in the book. I wrote Mr. Barnes and asked if I could name that principle Principal Hardwick after Tennyson Hardwick.
Oh, right. That was the mystery series that we did with Blair Underwood. Yeah. Look at that. You are making me grin from ear to ear. That's just beautiful. That's because Steve and I both have so much gratitude for our mentors, both those who knew they were mentoring us and those who did not know they were mentoring us just through their work. And yeah, thank you so much for sharing that. I'm very proud of myself. I'm proud of Steve. I'm proud of you. Group hug. So that is fantastic.
As a podcast network, our first priority has always been audio and the stories we're able to share with you. But we also sell merch, and organizing that was made both possible and easy with Shopify. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell and grow at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. They have an all-in-one e-commerce platform and in-person POS system, so wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. With the internet's best converting checkout, 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms, Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers. Shopify has allowed us to share something tangible with the podcast community we've built here, selling our beanies, sweatshirts, and mugs to fans of our shows without taking up too much time from all the other work we do to bring you even more great content. And it's not just us. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S. Shopify is also the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, and Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/realm, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/REALM now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/realm.
Hey there, this is Justin Bartha. I made a funny new podcast, King of the Egg Cream. It has the greatest cast in the history of podcasts with actors like Louis Black.
I'm torn by my feelings for two women.
Bobby Cannavale.
You can eat it. Or if someone hits you, you can put it on your cut.
Melanie Lynskey.
I wonder what these marvelous things are that look just like boiled chicken feet.
Jason Ritter.
I can break things and pick locks and kill people.
Michael Stuhlbarg.
The whole point is to inspire people that they should make themselves better.
Ari Grainer.
No, don't whet its appetite. What are you, an idiot?
Me, Justin Bartha.
That's not just any egg cream, that's a Lemke's special.
And all narrated by the hilarious Richard Kind.
This is the story of Harry Dalowitz and how he rose from nothing to become New York's King of the Egg Cream.
So if you like funny true stories, come listen to King of the Egg Cream, available wherever you get your podcasts.
And what was your journey for the publication? Did you start with short stories or did you publish a novel first?
Started with short stories, and that came from Stephen King's On Writing, because up till that book was published, I really didn't have a clue on how people got stories in front of other people. But if you know On Writing, you know Stephen King describes his process for writing and selling short stories and going through lengthy rejections before that happened for him. So once I knew that path, I started writing short stories. And honestly, the first short story I submitted when I was 21, I sold. And so
right away, out the gate.
I thought I was a prodigy. I thought I had it made. I was quickly humbled when I couldn't sell anything else for about 3 years.
That's how it works.
Yeah.
In my case, I sold one probably about the same age, but the publication went out of business before they even published the story. And I couldn't sell anything for years after.
So. But, You know, but I needed that humbling because having sold the first one out the gate, I thought I was about to be a billionaire. I was first young black.
Wait a minute now. Slow down. Wait. You said you thought you were about to be a billionaire from writing?
Yes. Yes.
Okay.
I needed to be taught lessons. The next sale was to Brandon Massey's Dark Dreams anthology.
Okay, we named our company after that, Dark Dream Productions.
Yeah, such a wonderful, wonderful collection.
Huge. Terrence Taylor was in there. Yes. I mean, yes.
L.A. Banks was in it.
L.A. Banks.
Yeah. So that got me going again. It was like a little spark of hope. But it wasn't that I was discouraged during those 3 years of rejections, because I remembered the Stephen King story. And in On Writing, he talked about putting a spike in his wall, and every rejection would go on the spike. And he got so many rejections that it eventually tore the spike out of the wall. So for me, every rejection was sort of like earning a merit badge. I counted it like, I got to get this part out of the way if I'm going to move on to the next part.
That is so critical. And I had forgotten about that part in On Writing, but that's definitely something I have taught from my experiences. I was very blessed to have a high school English teacher, Mrs. Estiver, who, you know, I went up to her, told her I wanted to be a writer. I had heard that she was a writer. And the advice she told me was, in order to be a writer, you have to wallpaper your wall with rejection slips. And that was not what I wanted to hear, but it was what I needed to hear. Because like you, I would paste them on the back of my door, you know, and I was getting rejected by some of the best publications in the country because my research skills were poor. So I was sending my stories to very inappropriate places. You know, like I was sending stories, you know, Ishmael Reed, pioneering Afrofuturist. I was sending him my short stories when I was still writing white protagonists, you know, had no kind of Afrofuturism angle at all. I was submitting to Playboy. I was submitting, you know, wherever. It was like, so I got a bunch of rejection slips. But that is so important because I think a lot of artists, actually, I won't even just contain it to artists. I think most of us people can get very easily discouraged from one no. Yeah. I mean, how many stories end because one person said no and you never pursued X, Y, or Z beyond that? Only discover it if you had kept it up, you would have gotten to yes. It's a process to get to yes. And that kind of fortitude is really important for writers. Lamar, what would you say your biggest disappointment has been in the arts? What's the one, like, even if you think about it now, it's like a kick in the stomach? Or have you had that moment yet? Maybe you haven't worked enough in Hollywood yet.
No, the biggest disappointment I've had, and this is after I was able to sell and publish novels, is that I discovered a thing that a lot of writers discover is, you know, if you're in the wrong publishing situation, the publisher may not even care if you survive.
Oh, let's talk about it. And that is especially true, I hear, with writers of color. This is something that writers of color come against. I don't know if that was an issue for you in particular, but...
Well, I found when we submitted my first novel, Fake ID, which was called Whispertown at the time, the rejections we were getting, like I said, I wasn't used to rejections. It wasn't that I couldn't take it, but these rejections were especially galling because they would say stuff like, we love the story, well-written, it's great, but we have someone that already does what Lamar does. And what they meant was they already had a black writer.
Oh, how did I guess, right, without even knowing the situation, the problem was?
We get stuff like, the book's great, but a black boy protagonist is dead in the water. That's literally what one rejection said. So that part was hard, but then we found an editor that took a chance on me and brought me into a publisher. But 6 months before Fake ID published, that editor just got a better job at a different publisher. They had to take it. It's one of those things, you got to take care of yourself. But with that editor being the only editor in publishing willing to take me on, I was orphaned, as the term goes. Not uncommon. It happens a lot. But it was incredibly disappointing to see how little regard the team I got left with had for my work. And
so they published it anyway.
Published it anyway.
But it had no advocacy.
No advocacy. It was almost negative advocacy. And I'll tell you this story. So I'm at this publisher and they moved my book from the typical teen imprint to what is traditionally the African-American imprint, which is fine. Not a big deal. The thing was, on that imprint at the time, the biggest author that was being published was Steve Harvey with the Think Like a Man book.
Okay.
And so this is where I'm going with this. At the time, Steve Harvey used to do this thing called like the Steve Harvey Dreamers Academy at Disney World every year, where they would bring in black boys from all over and do like motivational stuff for them. I used to work at Disney World. And so typically a publisher will ask you if you have any marketing ideas. And I'm like, well, hey, since I'm on the imprint with Mr. Harvey, can we talk to his people about me being a black boy, having worked at Disney World where he does this thing? Maybe we can get him a book. Maybe that can lead to something. And the answer was a flat out no.
Wouldn't even entertain it.
They wouldn't even entertain it. It was like, it was so strange. Like, no, we don't do stuff like that. You know, it was all these weird excuses. And I'm like, I don't understand, because you're not doing anything for the book. I'm trying to give you ideas that don't cost any money that could maybe lead to something. It makes sense to me. I'm like, can you at least just give me the contact information for one of his people? I know I can't reach out to Mr. Harvey directly. And it was just like, no, we'll just see how it goes. I mean, and so I honestly, when Fake ID came out, it got a little bit of buzz making it in the schools and libraries, but I honestly thought my career was over. The thing that I think really helped boost it was nominated for an Edgar Award from Mystery Writers of America the very next year, which kind of boosted the profile a little bit. And then my second novel, Endangered, also got nominated for an Edgar Award. So in those two regards, I had some outside help that kind of kept me viable when my publisher just didn't seem to care. And that bit of exposure actually put me on the radar for other editors and other publishers who gave me opportunities that I was able to build upon. But the disappointment was how little these people cared when that book was everything to me.
Oh, yeah. It just reminds me, Lamar, of that James Baldwin quote, which I hope I will not be mangling as I try to remember it. The price one pays for pursuing any profession or calling is an intimate knowledge of its ugly side. Mm-hmm. Like, you want to get in, you want to get in, you want to get in. Everything is about getting in. Then you get in.
Yeah.
And then once you cross that threshold, there's a whole world of challenges waiting. How did you keep yourself balanced during this time? Did you spin out? Did you have to take up some new practices to get through it? Or did you disappear in the work? What is your way when the things go wrong?
Well, I'd already decided I wasn't going to let some strangers in New York decide my fate. Before I published Fake ID, I was self-publishing stuff. And I plan to return to that if the traditional publishing route didn't work. And also, I have a life outside of my work. I was married at the time. I'm still married. My wife and I will celebrate 19 years.
Congratulations. That's great.
Thank you. I never put my entire heart and soul into this business because I just think that's unhealthy. And I think it would mean I'm neglecting home. So when things get rough, I focus on the house. I mean, sometimes that's literal. Sometimes that's me having to do a DIY project, fix the toilet.
My thing is doing the dishes.
Yeah. It's stuff to be done. And also at the end of the day, I recognize had my career stopped after two books, I still accomplished the goal I set out to accomplish.
It looks like we have a new entrant into our green room. Stephen Barnes is making an appearance. I sent him a text. I told you I was going to text him about Blood Brothers.
Yeah.
And I thought you two should speak because that is beautiful.
I just wanted to say that I'm really proud of you.
Thank you.
This is why we do this. That's why we teach. It's why we lecture. It's why we write. Because there are other minds out there just like ours. We just need to believe it's possible. So just wanted to drop in and say hi. I'm finishing up the Star Wars book today. And oh, nice. Is there anything you wanted to say?
No. First of all, I'm very happy to see you. Thank you for dropping in. And thank you for all you've done. Like I said, between you and Tanana Reeve, Brandon Massey, I wouldn't be here.
Brandon's a good brother.
He's great. I love him. You all show the path for so many of us after. Thank you. It's nothing else I can say right now other than
it's okay. We will sit down and break bread together one day and have awesome. A much more thorough conversation. And I'm going to leave this in your capable hands.
Yes. But I had a feeling you would want to pop in after that.
Yeah, you bet. Take care, everybody.
You too.
Okay, great. So isn't that nice? We had an appearance from Steve on the podcast just because he wanted to say, hey, yay. I'm telling you, that is what it is about, and what you're talking about in terms of not putting your entire feeling of self-worth into the hands of ultimately really strangers. You know, even if we're working with people, they're not that much more than strangers. I really appreciate that, and I think a lot of writers out there need to hear it. And also that self-publishing piece, we kind of skipped over that. Because how many books did you, or how many works? Was it full books you were self-publishing?
I self-published one full book. I did a collaboration with a writer friend I used to work with in corporate America. And I self-published a short story collection.
Oh, fantastic.
Those were all things I did before we sold Fake ID. And it was one of those things, like all over the country, I talked to people about the business and they asked me questions. And sometimes you hear, what do you think is better, self-publishing or traditional publishing? And I tell everybody, learn about both. There's pros and cons to both. You will find that you have so much more control over the self-publishing side, but you have to do a lot more things that the traditional publishing editors and publishing houses will do for you. So it just becomes like a preference, what makes sense for the story. And I say this, I've been traditionally publishing for a decade, but I don't rule out going and self-publishing things that I feel may not fit the traditional publishing model. Time has just been a factor for me these days.
Yes. Yes. I remember Victoria Christopher Murray talking about how that word self is so important when you're thinking about self-publishing. And I had a short story collection go summer some time ago. I ended up selling to a very tiny, tiny press, basically for $1,000, if I'm not mistaken. I mean, really almost giving it away. Because I didn't want to be bothered with all of the extra work of self-publishing. Although in retrospect, I do wish I had hired a copy editor because that first edition was riddled with copy editing errors. So I think writers who are listening here who may be feeling frustrated, it's kind of hard to determine where you are on this path to publication. Yes, you're collecting your rejection slips. At what point are those rejection slips no longer about the good faith of you're not quite ready yet? Your skill level isn't quite where it needs to be yet. This is half of a good story, but the second half doesn't work yet, to the other end, which is not coming from good faith, which is, like you said, black boys? I don't think so. Or racism or fear or, you know, just not interested. I can't relate because it's not about me. How do you tell the difference? How do you know when you should self-publish as opposed to when you continue to trust the system? And I ask that question knowing that things have changed since when you first started trying to publish. So some of those rejections you were getting, what, 10, 15 years ago, you wouldn't be getting now.
That would have been 2009, 2010, around that area.
Mm-hmm.
And
okay, 20 years ago. I can't do math. Can I do math? It's 24.
Almost 15.
Okay, 15. I can't do math.
It's close to 20. It's only off a little bit.
You're trying to trip me up. With numbers. I see what you're doing. Now go on.
So, like I say, it came a point when I realized I was writing sellable things. And I was just running into this wall of like, some editors just not going to mess with me because I'm black. I'm writing about black characters. And so, yeah, I, at the time, I was following the career of some writers who were exclusively self-publishing. And I had a full-time job, too. So that's the other thing. Like, I think, you know, that also gave me a little bit of security where I had security. I had money that I could use to go into the self-publishing endeavor. So it became a thing of like, I'm going to test the waters, like, because everything's not meant to go to the traditional publisher. A bunch of short stories I had, I didn't have anything to do with them. I thought they were good enough, throw them in a collection. You know, I called it the Shadows Gallery and went through at the time it was the Kindle Publishing Services, something like that. Was able to self-publish on through a print-on-demand service through Amazon, so I didn't have to keep stock in my house. If people order hard copies, they would print and send them. I learned how to use Photoshop.
Oh, right. Oh my goodness! So you're talking. You were doing your own fulfillment when you were self-publishing.
Oh yeah, yeah. I mean, shoot. This this is partially me being cheap too. And I would probably do it different. I would probably do it different these days, but I also learned how to use Photoshop and Illustrator so I can make my own covers.
Oh.
And I'm not saying they're excellent covers, but I set myself up to learn a skill that I still use today, and I'm way better at it. So now I make my own merch, my own bookmarks, things like that, promotional postcards when I go out. So it was a worthwhile endeavor. I didn't make a ton of money, but I learned a lot, and that skill still stays with me. Great. I don't know if I'm answering your question. I feel like I went off on a tangent.
Well, yeah. What's a sign? What would be a sign to you if a writer came up to you that they need to self-publish? Like, what kind of stories would convince you? Or would it be actually looking at the work?
I think I would say we need to look at the work, but I'll also ask them about their patience. Mm-hmm. Like, how urgent is it that they get these stories out into the world? Because the thing about the traditional publishing pipeline, and you know this, is it's slow.
Yes.
It's super slow. If you feel like you want to have work out in the world next year, traditional publishing is probably not going to suit that need if you're not already in it.
That's for sure.
And so I think that's the thing. How much do you trust the corporate overlords? Some people are very averse to the idea of an editor having a lot of say in what they do. With a designer telling them, this is the cover we're going with versus mm-hmm. something you might have in your head. Like, if mm-hmm. you don't like that sort of collaboration, I think self-publishing is a viable option.
Let me ask about the bent toward younger readers. Did that happen by accident or was that intentional?
It was intentional, but the way it came about was more of me not having grown up with the term young adult. When I was a teen reader, like, that just wasn't anything I'd ever heard before. It was like you were reading children's books, you were reading like Roald Dahl, and then that
yes.
Stephen King. And in the early 2000s, like, the hottest book on the planet, maybe this was the mid-2000s, was like Twilight. And that I'm hearing the term young adult for the first time related to that book. And I tried to read it. It just wasn't my thing. Nothing wrong with it. I know a lot of people loved it. But then there's a whole section where there's these other books. And I end up stumbling upon a book called Unwind by Neil Shusterman. And if you don't know this book, it's essentially a near future story about abortion being made illegal, but to compromise with people who want to still have that option, you can take your child once they turn 13 and have them retroactively aborted. Which is called
what? Unwanted.
Yeah.
Oh my God.
Like, the idea is, like, if you have a troubled child and they're 13 or older, you can actually turn them into like the government, and that child will be unwound. That's the politically correct term, where they're pretty much dismantled for parts.
Ooh.
And I just couldn't believe you were allowed to write this sort of thing for young people.
That's what I'm thinking, even for adults these days.
I was like, and once I saw that was an option, that you could go that deep and you could deal with those sorts of topics for young people, I immediately wanted to take my revenge on the English curriculum I've been exposed to in high school, where all we read about was old British kids from London and that sort of thing. I wanted to write the sort of stuff I would have liked reading when I was that age.
I bet that also dovetails into why you were one of the founding members of We Need Diverse Books. What drew you to that organizing? Because not a lot of artists are also organizers. Those are two different hats.
Well, I mean, the chief organizer of We Need Diverse Books is a writer named Ellen O, and she writes really fantastic fantasy novels. She's Korean American, and I met her in my first year of traditional publishing with Fake ID. We met at a book conference, and she told a story similar to stories we've told, which is growing up, not really seeing the books you wanted. You get a chance to write them, you do, but then you see the publishing is acting really kind of weird towards you, not a ton of support. And we realize that there are probably many, many, many writers with this story, which means there are probably many, many, many readers who are not being exposed to books that represent them because of this weird vibe in publishing that these stories aren't important. And so Ellen said, hey, do you want to help me with this idea of putting it out into the world that we need diverse books, that there's creators that make them, readers that need to see them, and publishing needs to step up. And so she pulled together me and several other creators, writers, and illustrators, and just simply started it as a Twitter hashtag. This was back, you know, this was back.
Remember that?
Yeah, yeah. And yes, that hashtag started to trend across the country within the first day it was out. And then it became one of Twitter's like top trending hashtags, like globally. And it put publishing on notice. All of us started getting invited to the conferences that our publishers wouldn't send us to before.
Interesting. All media
outlets wanted to talk to us. I mean, I got interviewed by NPR, that sort of thing. Off the strength of that, Ellen was like, we can't let this die. And so we formed a nonprofit to try to make sure this mission of making sure every child got a book that represented them kept going. And so we started giving out grants to creators who might have been struggling financially for a time. We started putting together programs where we would put cases of books into classrooms and send the author of those books to the class so that kids could see a writer in person or an illustrator in person that maybe looked like them. It was just a bunch of great programs to make sure that all creators got a chance to shine and that the readers who were looking for them could find them.
I love it. When you look at today, how different a world is it than when you started that hashtag?
There's been some great progress, but there's also been, I think, a lot of setbacks, particularly if you're talking about children's books, the various book challenges you're seeing across the country now, where books by people of color, people in the LGBTQ community, pretty much anything that's not like straight Christian white, there's a group of people challenging those books and trying to get them removed from schools and school libraries.
So ridiculous. Like yeah,
that was not that, those sort of challenges always existed, but not to this degree when we started We Need Diverse Books. So while I think many, many other creators have been able to come in and there's a larger variety of choice, I think there are also opponents out there trying to erase those gains. And that's not something I saw coming.
You know, and it seems naive in retrospect, but I agree with you. Whether it's the political boomerang that happened after President Obama that petrified a certain segment of the population, racist segment of the population so much that they would rather embrace Russia, which as a child who grew up, you know, with a required course called Americanism versus Communism. And that was the Soviet Union, and it's different. But still, it's really hard for me to relate to how the same people who were pushing us propaganda when I was in high school are now great with Russia. And I'm like, why is that? Why? What can it be? What is it about Russia that appeals? It's like, oh, whiteness.
Well, you know, somewhat related, I told my wife the other day, like, Facebook's an interesting platform because I can see the administrators from when I was in high school gleefully cheering on behavior from their favorite politician that they would have given me detention for.
I mean, it's really something. And that's why it's like, yeah, we were kind of caught. I guess I felt that we were just going to have sort of continuous upward progression. And I didn't take into account what the setbacks would be. But there definitely have been setbacks, whether it's, you know, the sort of so-called anti-woke movement, which is starting to get its own setbacks in Florida, from what I hear. Some of that is being getting pushback legally, thank goodness, not enough. But and also post George Floyd in the entertainment industry and probably throughout publishing, too, with all these pledges and so-called good intentions that we now see getting rolled back. So it is going to be ebbing and flowing up and down. But your work, I know because you write for young people and because young people are at that very vulnerable age where they're learning how to dream. So just by very definition, you are lighting fires with every book you write, showing readers who they can be, whether it's as authors or whether it's as powerful protagonists in their own stories, like we like to say on the Life Writing Podcast. Let me ask you this. Knowing what you know from the plot of your upcoming book, Ruined Road, that making that wish has unintended consequences, what would your wish be?
Well, knowing that wishes in fiction tend to turn out bad, but you know, we try to be mindful of how we word them. The thing I would wish, honestly, if I had the opportunity, I just want to see my daughter grow into a happy and healthy adult.
Yes. And yes. Yes. You need actually caveats. You need all kinds of caveats with a wish. A happy, healthy adult with a long life.
Yeah. Like, I probably had to draft that thing for about a week.
Yes. And the lawyer review it
before I sent it to the wish master. But I mean, if I had a single wish that, and that's part of the theme of the book, is, you know, it's this ongoing analogy to the game of life, like the actual board game. And the road you go on as you go through life. And when I had my daughter's only 2.5.
Oh.
Yeah, I had this realization that, you know, that my ideal win in the game of life is to be able to see her grow up healthy and happy. And the scary thing is that's a difficult thing. It's not guaranteed and not everybody gets that.
No, not everybody does get that, of course. And I absolutely wish that for you and for myself as well with my son. That is, you know, we're writers, but we're parents first, for sure. So I love what you said about leaning on your family during the setbacks. And I just want to take a moment because so many of the things that you talked about actually resonate in terms of our Life Writing Premium course that Steve and I sell as a digital download online, whether it's starting with short stories, whether it's sometimes it's just a matter of writing a sentence a day, which has gotten me through a lot of busy patches. But mostly it's about the diligence. And that's what you've heard. So what's great about a digital download course like the Life Writing Premium Program is that you get weekly modules. You do it at your own pace, but it's that little nudge. It's like, hey, what you working on right now? Did you forget your writing practice this week? So check it out. See if it's for you at www.lifewritingpremium.com. Lamar, congratulations on the upcoming book. It is available for pre-order. So don't feel like you have to wait for September. Pre-orders matter. They might even print more copies if they have to. So look for Ruin Road coming up soon. How can people find you on social media?
I'm easy to find. It's my name, LamarGiles.com. And I'm Lamar Giles on Instagram, which is my main social media platform these days.
I know. I've pretty much had to build up my Instagram too after the late unpleasantness over at Twitter.
Yeah, rest in peace, Twitter.
But you know what? I'm silly enough to think we're going to outlive that fool. So I keep one finger over there just because I feel like we're going to outlive him. I think Black Twitter could survive anything.
Yeah, I certainly hope we make a strong comeback. That was a fun platform. I think it was useful. I'm sorry that it's what it is now, but maybe we'll get there again.
Impactful, like TikTok today. That's a whole different episode about what's going on with TikTok. But those of you who are TikTok creators, write to your folks and see what you need to say, because I do think there is a fear of the outreach and the fear of change that social media platforms represent. And that is a threat to power structures, no matter what other reasons they give. And there may be good ones, but the threat to the power structures is always where I'm looking first. Anyway, now I don't mean to get off on a tangent. Lamar Giles, thank you so much for being on the Life Writing Podcast. Listeners, you go on and make yourself the hero or heroine of your own story. And as Steve would add at the end, the hero in a story of your lifetime. Goodbye, everybody.
You've been listening to the Life Writing Podcast. Join us next time for more conversations about creating the project of your dreams. For more information, go to lifewritingpremium.com and get ready to write for your life.